audio network of United Press International presents 1976 in Review, a documentary in sound of those events which had a profound effect on our lives during the year 1976. For the United States, 1976 was a year of historical significance. It was the 200th birthday of a republic which in 200 years had grown and prospered to become the unchallenged leader in the free world.
As we begin our third century, there is still so much to be done.
It was a year during which a relatively obscure peanut farmer challenged the better-known Democratic politicians and ultimately became their choice for the presidency.
My name is Jimmy Carter, and I'm running for president.
It was a year that the inhabitants on the Teton River, living below the Teton Dam, will never forget.
Look, there goes the whole side. There goes the whole complete side of the north edge of the Teton Dam. And the water in monumental, holy, great, what can I say? People downstream better get out.
A convention in the city of brotherly love for members of the American Legion turned into a mysteriously dreadful story as 29 persons lost their lives from what came to be known as the Legionnaires' disease.
The Pennsylvania Department of Health is continuing to closely monitor, track, and isolate cases of an unidentified disease which has, in such a short space of time, created tragedy and much concern in this commonwealth.
And so as we heard of mysterious deaths in 1976, we heard also of mysterious life, possibly life in some form as we know it on Earth, on the planet Mars. The start of the bicentennial year also heralded the beginning of that once every 4 years event we call election year. The Democratic hopefuls jockeyed quickly into position, and by the second week in January, 11 men had announced their intention to capture the Democratic nomination. They were all familiar names and recognizable political figures, but for one, and he eventually became the Democratic torchbearer and the next president. Jimmy Carter's victories in major primary battles soon made him the obvious choice, and by the time the Democratic convention took place, his nomination was assured. Things were far more confused on the Republican side when their convention began. President Ford was stiffly challenged for the nomination by former California Governor Ronald Reagan.
It begins to look that Jimmy Carter, not a member of the Washington establishment, running on criticism of the Washington establishment, is going to be the Democratic nominee. And Republicans have to ask themselves, who is better able to run against Mr. Carter and have a better chance of victory for our side?
Reagan garnered the support of conservatively bent Republicans and up until convention time loomed as a very serious threat to Ford. But while the Republican infighting was going on before their convention in Kansas City, the Democrats were making their choice in New York.
Convention of the Democratic Party of the United States will please come to order.
Proudly, I place before you the name of Jimmy Carter as the nominee of the Democratic Party and the next president of the United States.
My name Jimmy Carter, and I'm running for president.
In Kansas City, 1 month later, the drama was high as incumbent Ford and his opponent Reagan finished up a six-month battle for the right to represent the Republicans in the November election.
The 31st Republican National Convention in order on the 16th day of August in the bicentennial year of 1976.
State of West Virginia, fully mindful of the tremendous tenseness that has gripped this convention at this point, proudly presents its vote on behalf of our party's candidate for the presidency. 20 votes for Gerald R. Ford. I am honored by your nomination and I accept it.
I'm eager to go before the American people and debate the real issues face to face with Jimmy Carter.
The debates did take place. The first presidential debate since Kennedy and Nixon in 1960, and the first ever between an incumbent president and his challenger. While many say there was no apparent overall winner in the debates, they did give Ford and Carter a chance to present themselves openly to the American voting public. They got to hear Carter almost apologize for an interview he did with Playboy magazine, in which he used some frank language and revealed some honest thoughts he had on sex.
If I should ever decide in the future to discuss my deep Christian beliefs and condemnation and sinfulness, I'll use another forum besides Playboy.
The Ford watchers got to hear him in a slip of the tongue when he inadvertently declared some communist Eastern Bloc countries were not dominated by the Soviet Union.
I don't believe, Mr. Frankel, that the Yugoslavians consider themselves dominated by the Soviet Union. I don't believe that the Romanians consider themselves dominated by the Soviet Union. I don't believe that the Poles consider themselves dominated by the Soviet Union.
For Gerald Ford, the campaign was an uphill fight all the way. According to one poll, Carter had a 33% lead right after the Democratic convention. That lead slowly diminished during the three campaign months. In fact, on Election Day, many pollsters were calling it a toss-up to be decided by those voters who were still undecided. It was Carter's sweep of the South and the northern industrial cities that gave him 51% of the popular vote. It was enough strength for him to win a close electoral vote majority. For Ford, the first president in the nation's history not elected by the people, and the first incumbent to lose a presidential election since Herbert Hoover, the final days of the campaign were exhausting. So much so that the first lady, Betty Ford, had to help with his concession speech.
It's perfectly obvious that my voice isn't up to par, and I shouldn't be making very many comments, and I won't.
And so James Earl Carter, a nuclear physicist and peanut farmer, became the first Deep South president in over 100 years.
No one could have a campaign that had to be so thoroughly organized, hard-fought, and which has marshaled so much cooperation from hundreds of thousands of people around this country who've had confidence in me. And I pray that I can live up to your confidence and never disappoint you.
So 1976 was a political year. For one man, it was a year of political defeat, and for another, political victory. The celebration of the 200th birthday of the United States was a year-round happening as big cities and country villages found their own special way to mark the event. But it all came together on July 4th. President Ford started the day in Philadelphia, where some 1 million people had gathered at the nation's first capital. The scene, Independence Hall.
As we begin our third century, there is still so much to be done. We must increase the independence of the individual and the opportunity of all Americans to attain their full potential. We must ensure each citizen's right to privacy. We must create a more beautiful America, making human works conform to the harmony of nature. We must develop a safer society, so ordered that happiness may be pursued without fear of crime or man-made hazards.
The most spectacular party was held in New York Harbor. Over 6 million celebrants lined the shores of New York and New Jersey, or piled themselves into every size and shape sailing vessel to take part in the all-day affair called Operation Sail. The parade route was lined with hundreds of warships from many nations. They stretched from the Verrazano Bridge up the Hudson River to the George Washington Bridge. The highlight of the day was the parade of 16 tall ships from around the world, under sail, moving majestically up the Hudson. In honor of the bicentennial, Queen Elizabeth of England visited the United States to join in the celebration of the historical date.
In the next century and a half, we kept more closely to the principles of Magna Carta, which have been the common heritage of both our countries. We learned to respect the right of others to govern themselves in their own ways. This was the outcome of experience learned the hard way in 1776.
On July 15th, school bus driver Frank Ray had his usual load of 26 children on board. They were being driven home by Ray after attending a summer school session in Chowchilla, California. But that night, none of them made it home. Mysteriously, Frank Ray and his brood of 26 children had disappeared. 2 days later, 100 miles from Chowchilla, the hungry, tired, and frightened children were found, and they told an incredible tale. Three masked gunmen stopped their bus and herded them into two vans and drove 100 miles to Livermore, California. Once there, they were put into a makeshift prison at the bottom of a rock and gravel quarry. The 19 girls and 7 boys, whose ages ranged from 6 to 14 years, eventually dug their way out of the temporary grave and ran for help.
We got dug out. We handed all the kids up. I handed the kids up to the other boys, and we got out. Just lucky enough, there was a gravel pit right just within 200 feet of us, and a man over there, so jumped him, told him what happened. Well, he said, I heard that on the news, so he went and called the sheriff and the fire trucks and everything else was there. But we had a big crowd. We had a lot of crying and begging for their mamas and stuff, but I kept quieting them down. See, the guys wouldn't get mad at us.
After a 2-week search, 3 young men were arrested and charged with kidnapping. For most Americans, getting to and from work means driving a car or commuting by bus or train. But for some, if a body of water gets in the way, a ferry boat is a simple and usually safe and convenient way to go. And so it is for certain commuters who live on the Mississippi River, not far from New Orleans, Louisiana. And as they boarded the ferry that morning of October the 20th, they had no idea what fate had in mind for them that day.
Somebody hollered, get out your automobile. So I got out of my automobile and started towards the front of it. The next thing I know, wham! And all I could think about was doing and trying to swim to safety to get some hold to something or other. And whilst I was out there swimming, I swam up by some lifeguard jackets. And I grabbed 2 of them. And I tried to shove another one to another guy, but he never did get it.
It was a Norwegian tanker that came out of the fog and hit the ferry boat broadside. The ferry boat heaved on its side and sunk within minutes. When it was over, 78 passengers were dead. Every few years, a new strain of flu appears, and 1976 was one of those years. The strain this time was an old one, which last appeared in 1919 and caused a flu pandemic at the time. It was the swine flu, and the alarm was sent as a result of the death of an Army recruit at Fort Dix, New Jersey. President Ford acted immediately with this announcement.
I am asking each and every American to make certain he or she receives an inoculation this fall. The facts that have been presented to me in the last few days have come from many of the best medical minds in this country. These facts do not suggest there is any cause for alarm. The scientific community essentially understands what we are dealing with, and they have developed a vaccine that will be effective in combating it.
The nationwide program went into effect in the fall in hopes that most everyone would be inoculated. But a strange thing happened. Within 48 hours after receiving the flu vaccine, 9 states reported that 14 persons had died. Naturally, enthusiasm to receive that recommended vaccine waned considerably because of the deaths. Many people either thought the government was overreacting and there was no clear danger from swine flu, or they thought the flu shot itself was dangerous. But an apparent swine flu case in Missouri a few weeks later gave the government program the shot in the arm it needed, and people flocked to the designated vaccine centers in their communities. However, the total number of people receiving the shot by the end of the year was still way below government expectations. Another medical story was big news in 1976, and this involved members of the American Legion who attended a convention at the Bellevue Stratford Hotel in Philadelphia. In the aftermath of the convention, 29 persons were dead. All died after they left the convention, and all had stayed at the Bellevue Hotel. Medical officials had no concrete explanation.
The Pennsylvania Department of Health is continuing to closely monitor, track, and isolate cases of an unidentified disease which has, in such a short space of time, created tragedy and much concern in this Commonwealth. I wish I could offer more information at the beginning of the second day of our involvement into the investigation of this disease. Unfortunately, I cannot. Throughout the evening and early morning hours, it became apparent from our reporting system that the disease has not leveled off. Apparently, both deaths and the number of new cases of the disease have increased and are increasing.
What survivors told investigators was of little help in determining the cause of the deaths.
Come on me, boom, just like that. Saturday night. I got home Saturday night, I was down at the American Legion Club, and I come home and I was feeling all right, and it hit me all at once. And I took a couple of thionyl tablets before I went to bed, and I got up yesterday morning, and I still had a temperature over 100. And I kept taking tablets, and I kept going up to 102, and then I called my doctor.
Toward the end of the year, there was still nothing substantive. Officials had ruled out bacteria and food or water contamination, swine flu, and 17 toxic metals as probable causes. The so-called Legionnaires' disease was indeed a bewildering puzzle. The investigation eventually led to reports that someone with a more than common knowledge of some toxic substance, such as nickel carbonyl, may have been responsible for the deaths. Coming up next on 1976 in Review, a reporter watches in disbelief as a giant dam gives way and a mountain of water cascades, leaving a trail of death and destruction. Geologists and environmentalists had given a warning years ago. The Teton Dam site in Idaho was dangerous. They claimed the geology of the land made it unfit for the dam to be built. That was in 1971. Then 5 years later, their prediction proved right. Don Ellis was on the scene.
We do have a very, very serious problem here at the Teton Dam. The whole north side of the downstream face, the downstream side of the dam, the whole north side is caving in. And water is coming through in monumental amounts. As I sit here and watch, I mean, you see it caving. It's just coming apart. It's completely coming apart. Water is coming through on the north side of the dam, on the downstream side, and it's getting us more and more and more mud, dirt, water, and that whole downstream face on the north side of the dam is completely caving in. Now, there's going to be a lot of water come down the Teton River. As a matter of fact, it's coming down now. An awful lot of water is going to be coming down that Teton River. My advice to people downstream that are living along the Teton River, to get your belongings. Get your belongings. Now, look, Lisa, look, look. There goes the whole side. There goes the whole complete side of the north edge of the Teton Dam. And the water in monumental, holy, great. What can I say? People downstream better get out. People downstream better get out.
The Teton Dam was a 310-foot-high mound of dirt that held back the Snake River. The dam was looked on as a necessary and important part of the Snake River Valley. It helped control flooding during the spring thaws, and it contributed to the vital irrigation projects. But because it was built over the objections of some geologists and environmentalists, an investigation was started immediately. As for the people living in the valley, it was an experience they'll never forget.
The whole wall has fallen out where the fireplace is. The house has been moved about 4 inches off its foundation. It's complete demolition.
There must have been, we don't know how many thousand animals in the area that were destroyed. By animals, I mean steers and cattle and sheep and hogs. Some of those ended up in someone's front living room. A lot of them in stores. And then many just around the streets. And we had to clean those up.
Debris is scattered all over the downtown area. A new car lot down the street still has cars on display, but some of them are upside down and others are covered with mud. I'm standing in front of a house that was swept off its foundations. It's now standing about 3 blocks away from where it was located Saturday. I talked to the owner, Mrs. Neva Newton, and she said she considered herself fortunate. At least we're going to be able to save some of the furniture, she said. Others have nothing left. This is Gene Gibbons in Rexburg, Idaho.
After 3 days of flooding, the waters began to recede, leaving at least 9 persons dead, 30 missing, and some 4,000 homes and businesses destroyed. Natural disasters took more than their expected toll during 1976. A flash flood caused by heavy rains killed more than 130 people in Colorado's Big Thompson Canyon. Reporter Jim Henton was there.
The dead, injured, and stranded are victims of a wall of water 10 to 15 feet high that slammed down the canyon Saturday night. The swirling, mucky torrent splintered 75% of the houses and summer homes in the area, tossed about automobiles and recreational vehicles like toys. The road from Loveland only runs for 7 miles and then vanishes altogether. On our way up the canyon, we viewed a location where a number of the bodies were found. It's at the foot of about a 50-foot cliff that rises along a high spot in the highway. A number of persons took refuge from the water under the cliff. The cliff collapsed on them. Along what remains of the road, debris has been deposited by the thousands of tons. Cars sit ridiculously askew. It is under these cars police fear they will find more bodies.
It was the earthquake, however, which showed relentless persistence during the year throughout the world. February, Guatemala, 23,000 dead. May, Italy, 500 dead, 150,000 homeless. August, the Philippines, 4,000 dead, 4,000 missing. November, Turkey, 3,000 dead. July, China, one measuring 8.2 on the Richter scale, the strongest recorded earthquake in 12 years, an estimated 100,000 dead. Gough Whitlam, former Prime Minister of Australia, was in China the day the earth opened, and here is what he saw.
It struck just before 4 in the morning. All I can tell you is from what we observed in our hotel, which is the tallest building in Tianjin, the severity of the earthquake was shown by the fact that the furniture in our room was overturned. A large dressing table with a very large central mirror collapsed over the end of the bed that my wife had a leg cut.
But the death of possibly 100,000 people in China did not have the worldwide impact, as did the death of just two Chinese leaders during 1976, Zhou Enlai and Mao Zedong. Zhou, who was the Chinese prime minister for over 25 years, passed away in January following a long illness. Congresswoman Margaret Heckler of Massachusetts was in China when Zhou's death was announced.
The mood has certainly been one of considerable sadness. Nonetheless, the people are continuing their everyday activities, and as one Chinese leader said to me, we intend to gain strength in our grief through the pursuit of our own ordinary occupations. So that the Chinese society has not come to a halt, but the broadcast stations are playing funereal music. They have recited the list of dignitaries from all levels of society who are on the memorial committee. And in general, there's a great deal of reverence being paid to the premier. However, the sadness is not overwhelming the people. They're carrying on.
But it was the death of the Chinese political and spiritual leader Mao Zedong that affected the Chinese more. Warren Duncan reports from Peking.
In the streets, the scene is absolutely normal. And the overwhelming impression is that people have been well prepared for this news. There have been no reports of gatherings and very little sign of public grief. The announcement made by the government about arrangements for the period of official mourning laid great stress on the need for local leaders to organize the people to pay their respects in their own units, factories, or workshops.
President Ford, who met Mao during his visit to China in 1975, had this to say about Mao Zedong.
Chairman Mao was a giant figure in modern Chinese history. He was a leader whose actions profoundly affected the development of his own country. His influence on history will extend far beyond the borders of China. Americans will remember that it was under Chairman Mao that China moved together with the United States to end a generation of hostility and to launch a new and more positive era in relations between our two countries.
Mao, who was the Chinese Communist Party chairman and had led the Chinese since 1949, left no designated heir, and his death made the political situation in China cloudy. But an internal power struggle was ended quickly as Mao's widow and three others were arrested, and Hua Kuofeng, who became the premier shortly after Zhou's death, was elevated to the chairmanship. In the Middle East in 1976, attention most of the year focused on the Lebanese Civil War. The Lebanese Civil War in 1976 was one of ceasefires and broken truces. Syria intervened early in the year, sending in its troops to enforce a ceasefire announced in January. But by March, the war had resumed and the country was once again in turmoil. Syria responded by bringing in more troops, and by June 19th, other Arab League countries agreed to bring in an Arab peacekeeping force. 5 days before the Arab forces were to enter the country, the U.S. ambassador to Lebanon, Francis Malloy, was kidnapped along with his economic counselor and a Lebanese chauffeur. The three men were captured as they were on their way to a meeting with the newly elected president. All three were shot to death. The assassinations prompted an evacuation of U.S. citizens from Beirut. Doyle McManus was on one of the evacuation ships.
Tired but happy American evacuees from Lebanon are lining the rails here on the rescue ship Spiegel Grove, watching the sunrise over the Greek mainland and feeling what it's like to be back in civilization. It wasn't an easy 46-hour trip. Saltwater pipes broke and flooded the women's sleeping quarters, forcing some passengers to sleep on deck. Others were hit by seasickness as the ship ran into heavy seas. But there were no complaints. This was no desperate evacuation under fire, but instead a convenient way for 276 Americans and other foreign nationals to get out of Lebanon. As one man said, I've always wanted to take a Mediterranean cruise.
By October, the presence of the Arab forces seemed to be effective in keeping the ceasefire, and the opening of the Beirut airport was a sign that the situation had improved. So the 18-month civil war may have ended in 1976, but only after some 35,000 deaths and billions of dollars in damage was realized by that country. One of the most intriguing stories of the year reached its climax in the African country of Uganda. It started on June 27th. Seven pro-Palestinian guerrillas hijacked a plane in Athens. The plane was on its way to Paris from Tel Aviv when it was rerouted by the hijackers. They demanded to be taken to Entebbe, Uganda. The hijackers wanted the release from Israel of some 50 Palestinian prisoners, or they said they would blow up the plane and the hostages. Eventually, 147 of the 250 passengers were released by the hijackers as they waited for the demands to be met. Then one night, 7 days after the drama began, three Israeli planes landed at Entebbe Airport. They freed the hostages using machine guns and grenade support and cut down the seven guerrillas. They rushed the hostages into planes and flew immediately back to Tel Aviv. Israelis celebrated the rescue by dancing and parading in the streets. Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin spoke to the nation over radio.
Unless there will be such full cooperation, the whole world will see the growing disease of the cancer of terrorism in the fabric of our society.
Black unrest in South Africa during the summer months led to hundreds being killed and millions of dollars in damages. In black townships on the outskirts of Johannesburg, from Pretoria to Cape Town, blacks protested language requirements and apartheid policies which exclude blacks from participation in the South African government. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger made Africa one of his diplomatic targets in 1976. One of his aims was to get Rhodesia to agree to an eventual black majority government ruling that country. Rhodesian Prime Minister Smith told his people of the decision to comply with Kissinger's plan.
It was made abundantly clear to me and to my colleagues who accompanied me that as long as the present circumstances in Rhodesia prevailed, we could expect no help or support of any kind from the free world.
As the year came to an end, a final agreement between Rhodesia and black African states had not been reached, but negotiations continued with hopes of ending the stalemate. Since Angola was given its independence from Portugal in 1975, there had been a power struggle for control of the country. That struggle may have ended in 1976 when the Soviet-backed Popular Movement for the Liberation of Angola announced it had won the civil war. The Popular Movement forces were strongly aided by Cuban soldiers. One American who was a mercenary soldier was executed by the Angolans for his part in the civil war. In a year filled with political and economic crisis, the Italian people went to the polls and gave the Communist Party their strongest vote ever in that country. The Communists won 34% of the House and Senate seats for their best showing in Italy ever. Their new strength also gave them the chairmanships of four parliamentary committees. In Argentina, a military coup threw out the government of Isabel Perón, who had led that nation ever since her husband died in 1974. A three-man military junta took over with Army Commander General Jorge Rafael named president. In Southeast Asia, North and South Vietnam were officially reunited in 1976. Hanoi was named the capital and the former North Vietnamese flag, anthem, and emblems were adopted as the official symbols of the new nation. At the Panmunjom truce site on the border of North and South Korea, a group of U.S. and South Korean soldiers went on a tree-cutting expedition to improve the surveillance conditions at the site. This apparently provoked the North Korean troops into attacking and killing two American Army officers in the group. The U.S. troops in the area were ordered on a full military alert, and Henry Kissinger demanded an explanation from the North Korean government.
We consider the killing of the two American
American officers. One act of murder, which we will hold the North Korean authorities responsible for all consequences.
The North Koreans never admitted responsibility for the act, and eventually a new agreement on security arrangements was made between the opposing sides in an attempt to avoid any future incidents. In Poland, the government announced food prices were being raised, so the Polish workers said they'd had enough and they rioted. Correspondent Edwin Smith was in Radom, Poland at the time.
The story that the residents told me was that it started out with a demonstration by workers who'd gone on strike when these food price increases were announced. Things got nasty around Communist Party headquarters. They started throwing stones, and then someone set the building alight. But it was only later in the day that, as the residents put it, thieves and looters took over and started attacking food stores and liquor stores particularly. The police used tear gas to disperse them, and they did arrest several.
In Sweden, after more than 40 years of being the government power, the Social Democrats were booted out of office by the Swedish electorate. A narrow victory gave control to a coalition of three non-socialist parties. There has always been some fear that the inhabitants of Quebec province in Canada, of which 80% are French-speaking, would make a move to secede from Canada. Some of the French-Canadians there say they would get a better break economically and culturally if they formed a new French nation. Well, those fears were strengthened in 1976 when the Parti Québécois, led by René Lévesque, who was an active secessionist, gained control of the government by winning 70 of the 110 seats in the National Assembly of Quebec Province. This prompted a nationwide radio and television speech by Canadian Prime Minister Elliott Trudeau, who told the Canadians that the federal government in Ottawa would not tolerate Quebec seceding from the nation.
I believe that it's possible to be at the same time a good Canadian and a good Quebecer, just as it's possible to be a good Canadian and a good Nova Scotian or a good British Columbian. And I will fight to the end against anyone who wants to prevent me from being both.
Just a year ago, I reported that the State of the Union was not good. Tonight, I report that the State of our Union is better. In many ways, a lot better, but still not good enough.
In his State of the Union message, President Ford asked Congress to show restraint and eliminate expensive new programs. He asked for tax reductions and tax breaks. In short, he asked for help in slowing inflation and for programs that would speed up the recovery from recession. The beginning of the year was encouraging. Unemployment was down, consumer prices rose at a low rate during the first quarter of the year, and the Dow Jones stock average went over the 1,000 mark in March, the highest closing level since 1973. But by the end of the year, that recovery began to lag. And while housing starts had a sharp rise in the fall, usually a good economic measure, the Labor Department reported that the real buying power of the typical worker had continued to decline. And then the unemployment figures released in November showed that the number of those not working was higher than it had been all year. Ever since Watergate and the revelations of how the U.S. intelligence agencies in some cases abuse their privileges, there has been a public call for change in U.S. intelligence activities. So in early 1976, President Ford announced dramatic reform and reorganization of the agencies.
We must not become obsessed with the deeds of the past. We must act for the future. Tonight, I'm announcing plans for the first major reorganization of the intelligence community since 1947. First, I am establishing by executive order a new command structure for foreign intelligence. Henceforth, overall policy directions for intelligence will rest in only one place, the National Security Council, consisting of the President, the Vice President, Secretary of State, and Secretary of Defense.
The reform set rigid regulations on the collection and dissemination of information about Americans and sharply restricted the power of intelligence agencies to intrude upon the lives and activities of U.S. citizens. In April, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence Activities issued two reports which climaxed a 15-month study. The reports dealt with foreign and military intelligence and domestic intelligence activities. The committee, headed by Senator Frank Church of Idaho, made many recommendations and severely criticized the FBI, charging they had knowingly and repeatedly violated laws and the Constitution in their investigations of the political activities of hundreds of thousands of law-abiding U.S. citizens.
I think that
covert operations have done this country much more harm than good, and that when we imitate the Russians in our dealings with foreign people by resorting, as we so often have done in the past, to blackmail, bribery, false propaganda, abduction, conspiracy to murder, that we demean ourselves and betray our own principles.
At the same time, other politicians worried about the intelligence operations becoming overregulated and therefore ineffective. Senator Howard Baker of Tennessee.
On balance, there's the danger that we may be tempted to recommend over-reform. I think we may get too far into the detailed daily operations of the intelligence community and make it extremely difficult, if not impossible, for them to function effectively and appropriately.
At the beginning of 1976, Representative Wayne Hayes of Ohio was one of the most powerful political figures in Washington. But by September, Hayes had resigned from office and was a beaten man politically and physically. He had been dragged down by the disclosure and his admitting he had an affair with a member of his staff. The shapely blonde staff member, Elizabeth Ray, blew the whistle on Hayes by saying in a newspaper interview that Hayes hired her for sexual favors only and that she didn't even know how to type. A few months later, Hayes took an overdose of sleeping pills and shortly after his recovery, resigned as chairman of one of the four committees he headed. Then as a final move in September, Hayes resigned from the House altogether and from the seat he had held for 28 years. The Lockheed Aircraft Corporation admitted it had paid some $22 million in bribes overseas, but it took a Senate committee investigation to reveal who the foreign payoffs went to. In Japan, former Prime Minister Tanaka was indicted on accepting bribes of almost $2 million to help Lockheed sales in that country. The SST Concorde, faster-than-sound plane, finally got permission to land in the United States in 1976. But only on a limited basis and not at any New York City airports where protesters opposed the Concorde flights. But in Washington in May, both Air France and British Airways made the historic flight to Dulles Airport, and Pye Chamberlain was there.
Looks like an intelligent, dangerous bird made out of steel and painted white, with blue lettering and a little bit of red trim. And now from the right side, the British Airways plane aims its pointy nose at the French plane. I don't think anything like this has ever happened before. This is one of the strangest sights I have ever seen. These two big white planes pointing their dagger noses, their beaks at each other. They're inching towards each other, just barely moving. What a weird media event. Two supersonic airliners on the ground here at Dulles Airport.
Secretary of Agriculture Earl Butz, whose off-the-cuff comments had gotten him in trouble before, finally had to resign in the face of mounting criticism directed at him for making a racist statement derogatory of blacks.
I have submitted my resignation to the President as a member of the Cabinet. This is the price I pay for a gross indiscretion in a private conversation. The use of a bad racial commentary in no way reflects my real attitude. By taking this action, I hope to remove even the appearance of racism as an issue in the Ford campaign.
Back in 1974, when he first became the British Prime Minister for the second time, Harold Wilson made an irrevocable decision not to stay in office for more than 2 years. So in 1976, Wilson resigned.
The one thing I've always rejected in politics is the doctrine of indispensability of a particular leader. I have never thought I was indispensable. This is a view that's been shared by some of my colleagues over the years, though they're more united now. It's a view that has been almost unitedly shared by the press over many years. But they are being very kind now. And I've taken the same view about leaders of the Conservative Party over the years. Once a person is considered indispensable, I believe that's a real threat to democracy.
Wilson's resignation came at a very sensitive and critical time in British history as the country tried to pull out of a sharp economic decline which saw inflation grow and the pound sink lower and lower in value. Wilson's post was taken over by Foreign Secretary James Callaghan.
You know, as I do,
that we face two deep-seated problems, inflation and unemployment. Both of them are still too high. I therefore emphasize at the outset that the new government's aim will be to drive on with the vital job of bringing down the rate of inflation.
Life is very precious to me, but I have no delusions that going to prison will keep me alive. And I would never choose to live the rest of my life surrounded by pigs like the Hearsts.
That was Patty Hearst speaking in 1974 on a tape-recorded message she made shortly after being kidnapped. This tape and others like it were all part of the evidence put together for her bank robbery trial, which came to an end in 1976. The jury convicted Patty of the armed robbery charge, and the judge imposed a sentence of 7 years in prison. In his summation, prosecuting attorney James Browning told the jury that Patty's testimony saying she was threatened with death if she did not comply with her abductors was too big a pill to swallow. He reacted to the verdict.
I fully concur in the jury's verdict. I think it's an entirely proper verdict. We're very pleased with it. I think it's going to bear out what most Americans believe, and that is that our American system of criminal justice works very well.
But Patty didn't stay in jail too long after her sentencing. The bail was set, and her father, William Randolph Hearst, posted $1.25 million, and soon Patty was living in seclusion with her parents. As she was leaving the prison, Patty managed this short statement for newsmen.
Well, it would be a lot better if I were home right now, and I'd like to get this over with so I can go home.
And so a story that began almost 3 years earlier with the kidnapping of Miss Hearst seemed to have come to an end. 1976 was a banner year for U.S. space scientists as the Viking 1 spacecraft became the first spacecraft to make a successful soft landing on another planet. The day was July 20th, 7 years to the day man first stepped on the moon, and the planet was Mars.
We're looking good.
Viking 1 began sending back black and white photographs of the planet. The very next day, however, color photographs were sent back to Earth, showing a light blue sky and reddish soil. Then after a month of scientific testing and analyzing, scientists at the labs made this startling announcement.
In one of our experiments, the gas exchange experiment, we believe that we have at least preliminary evidence for a very active surface material. Now, I'll get back to that in a moment. We believe that there's something in the surface, some chemical or physical entity, which is affording the surface material a great activity and may, in fact, mimic, and let me emphasize that, may mimic in some respects biological activity.
While the tests were still very inconclusive, the possibility that there is some sort of life on Mars still exists. In one of the most bizarre stories of the year, Gary Gilmore, a convicted killer in Utah, announced that he wanted to die, that he was ready to be executed by a firing squad, that he was relinquishing his right to appeal the death sentence. When his execution date was postponed by the governor of Utah, Gilmore and his girlfriend, in an apparent suicide pact, took an overdose of sleeping pills. The Utah Board of Pardons met with Gilmore and heard him try to explain why he wanted to die.
I simply accepted a sentence that was given to me. I've accepted sentences all my life. I didn't know I had a choice in the matter. When I did accept it, everybody jumped up and wanted to start to argue with me. It seems that the people, especially the people of Utah, they want the death penalty, but they don't want executions. And when it became a reality, they might have to carry one out. Well, I started backing off on it. Well, I took them literal and serious, and they sentenced me to death, just as if they had sentenced me to 10 years or 30 days in the county jail or something. I thought you were supposed to take them serious. I didn't know it was a joke.
The review board finally decided in Gilmore's favor and set another execution date. But pressed by an appeal from Gilmore's mother, the Supreme Court stepped in, and on December the 3rd, the execution date was postponed once again. A TWA jet plane en route from New York to Chicago was hijacked by five Croatian nationalists, and after a two-day siege, the five surrendered in Paris. The group supports Croatian independence from Yugoslavia and used the hijack as a means to get their message to the world. They wound up in Paris after forcing the plane to Montreal, Newfoundland, and Iceland. Some of the plane pirates' demands were met, such as dropping thousands of propaganda leaflets professing their beliefs over the cities of London, Paris, Chicago, Montreal, and New York. On their return to New York after their surrender, the group was charged with air piracy and murder. A New York City policeman was fatally injured while dismantling a bomb which the Croatians took credit for planting in a locker in the Grand Central Railroad station. New York Mayor Abe Beame reacted vigorously.
I can say the madman, crazy, and it's only people like that which can do a crazy thing as was done here, and jeopardize so many lives, and all for a cause which they know will not be solved by reason of that kind of a problem.
One of the passengers on board the plane was Gerald Ambrose of Chicago. He tells how the incident finally came to an end.
We knew it was finally over when the hijackers came back and said that their bombs were not real and that we were going to be released and that they were going to surrender.
Every year has its fad, and so did 1976. It was a fad that brought a whole new jargon into the lives of thousands of Americans. Terms like Breaker 19 and Got Your Ears On, Good Buddy? Well, it's called the CB craze, and it means Citizens Band Radio. While CB radios are nothing new, the craze took hold in 1976 as thousands of Americans had CBs installed in their cars. And, of course, any new fad seems to bring out the kookiness in people, and so it was with the CBs. Anita Cole and Earl Yoel are CB freaks, and so are a lot of their friends. So when Anita and Earl decided to get married in Albany, Georgia, they found a minister with a CB and told all the invited guests to meet them at a parking lot with their ears on. This is what it sounded like.
Will you love, comfort, serve, and honor him? Stand by him in sickness and in health, forsaking all others. Will thou cleave unto him and unto him alone, as long as ye both shall live?
30:12, I will.
What God has joined together, let no man put asunder. By the power invested in me as a minister of the gospel, I now pronounce you man and wife. In the name of the Father, of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost. Let us 10-7 now with 15 seconds of silent prayer.
And so the year is finished. 1976 is history. Some things changed, some stayed the same. Some lived and some died. Times were abnormal and times were typical. So the measure of 1976 is as diverse as the ideas and stories the year held. You've been listening to 1976 in Review. This program was written and produced by Stan Savick, technical supervision by Frank Shortino. Production assistance and tape research by Tom Foti, and I'm Ed Cairns. This program is a production of the United Press International Audio Network.